Hello and welcome to the Kim Iverson Show. Thank you so much for joining us here on our new showtime, 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern. We do have a great show for you tonight. What would you do if you were prosecuted, literally prosecuted, for speaking out against COVID tyranny? That's what happened to C.J. Hopkins, an American living in Germany who's now been convicted under Nazi-era laws for the cover of his book, The Rise of the New Normal Reich. His so-called crime? Using satire to criticize the German government's COVID policies, comparing them to the totalitarianism of the Nazis. We'll talk about him. We'll talk with him tonight about his case. It's unfortunately not over, and I think it's a precursor to what we can soon expect here in the U.S., unfortunately. He's also just released a new follow-up book called Fear and Loathing in the New Normal Reich, documenting this disturbing rise of state censorship and thought policing across the West. C.J. Hopkins has spent years fighting globalist groupthink, medical authoritarianism, and political hypocrisy. We're happy to have him with us tonight. C.J. Hopkins, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, Kim. I appreciate it.
All right, let's start off with, we're going to talk about you being prosecuted in Germany for the cover of your book. Why are you in Germany, first of all?
That's another long story. I kind of bailed out of New York City in 2004, I think it was, and for a lot of reasons. A lot of people think it was just the politics, which it was. Partly this was, you know, back during the occupation of Iraq and the whole war on terror hysteria. And I was pretty sick of the mood in the States at the time. But also it was partly just quality of life. I had been bouncing around in Europe with one of my plays, and I just liked the lifestyle. And I thought, you know, why not? I'll give this a try, do the Henry Miller thing.
And so you chose Germany. Of all the places you could have chosen in Europe, like, why not Portugal? Why not Greece? Why not Italy? Why Germany?
It's going to be a really disappointing answer. Germany was basically the easiest place to set up camp in at the time. And at that time, Berlin was, they used to call it the, you know, the slogan was poor but sexy. And at that point, Berlin was ridiculously cheap. Extremely bohemian, and I just kind of fit right in back in those days.
Okay.
And it was the easiest place to set up camp.
And you said this was 20 years ago?
Yeah.
Wow. Do you speak fluent German?
Sure, badly. It's an embarrassment, but yeah, I speak fluent German.
Okay. Kind of matters. I mean, if you're going through, we don't think about these types of things when we're living in foreign countries until you get slapped with a court, with criminal charges. And then that's when it really starts to matter, right? A lot more that you can understand the language. They're not speaking English in these hearings, are they?
Well, they're not even speaking German. It's German legalese, if you can imagine that. No, they're not speaking English at all. Everything's done in German.
Okay.
Yeah. And the statements that I made to the court were made in German as well.
So tell us about, what are they coming after you for criminally?
All right. Well, here's the whole long story. And, you know, please stop me and interrupt me if you have questions or if I just go on too long. I was a pretty vociferous COVID measures critic right from the very beginning, back in March and April of 2020. Wrote a lot of columns about it, collected a bunch of them in a book that was published in 2022, The Rise of the New Normal Reich. And my brilliant cover artist, Anthony Freda, and I, when we created the cover, what we did is we stole the cover of William Shirer's world-famous book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Old people like me will remember this cover. It's all black with red type. And down below the title, there's a little white circle with a swastika in it. It's the history of Nazi Germany. So we basically stole this cover, and then we put a medical-looking mask, one of the COVID masks, over the top of the swastika. So you see the medical mask, and then faintly behind it, there's a, what is that? It's a, oh my God, it's a swastika. So that was the cover of the book, published the book. Book did really well, Amazon bestseller in various countries. So everything was fine. Jump forward to, I think it was August of 2022, Yeah, that's right. In Germany, they were having a big debate about, should we continue to force everyone to wear medical-looking masks in public all the time? I know it ended earlier in the States, but in Germany, the mandates were still ongoing. There was a big uproar. Germans were like, no, we have to keep the mask mandates. Everyone has to be forced to wear these medical masks at all time. And I put a couple of tweets out. I used the cover art of the book. And one tweet, I basically was just saying that the masks are ideological conformity symbols, and that's all they really are. It's theater. And the other tweet, I made fun of the German health minister, Karl Lauterbach, used one of his quotes. He was quoted as saying, you know, the masks always send out a signal. And I thought, yeah, that's exactly my point, Carl. That's what they're for, is to send out a signal. So I sent that tweet as well, and I used the cover art of the book on both tweets. A little bit later, and this all happened within a 48-hour period, the tweets were censored by Twitter. My book was banned by Amazon in Germany, in Austria, and the Netherlands. It was also essentially banned in German bookstores. You can't get it in German bookstores anymore. And a criminal investigation was opened, and I received a notice a little bit later that I was charged with basically disseminating Nazi propaganda for using the swastika in this cover artwork of my book. Mm. So that was the beginning of it. This criminal investigation was launched. I got a lawyer. We protested, you know, filed briefs back, ended up in court and in district court here in Berlin, where I was acquitted, of course. A lot of Americans don't know. They think that, you know, displaying swastikas and, you know, Nazi iconography is completely banned in Germany. And it is if you're a Nazi. Right. There's a ban on it if you're promoting Nazism or neo-Nazism. Mm-hmm. But of course, there are numerous exceptions to this ban. You know, you couldn't teach a history class or show a Quentin Tarantino movie or a Rammstein video if there weren't exceptions to the ban.
Got it.
One of the exceptions to the ban is if you're using the symbol to counter or to protest against anti-constitutional activity. Yeah, then you are allowed to, which is, of course, exactly what I was doing.
Right.
Art is another exception to the ban. So the judge in my first trial recognized all of that, and she acquitted me. She thought I was an idiot, and she told me so in court. But, you know, she said, Mr. Hopkins, you're a jerk, basically. But what you did is not illegal. And so I was acquitted.
Okay, can I ask you, were you surprised when you were first charged? Or did you expect it, knowing that... Oh, you were shocked. So you didn't think...
No, I mean,
you know the law in Germany, right? You know that displaying swastikas is very serious in Germany. They crack down on this heavily. So when you chose to use this as the artwork for the cover of your book, I mean, did you even have a second thought? Like, you know, are they going to maybe come after me for this? Or was there no thinking of that at all?
No, there really wasn't, because what people have to understand is swastikas are displayed all the time when they fall under these exceptions to the ban. I was going to give you an example later, but I'll give you an example. I'll give you the example now. Shortly before my second trial, which is what I'm going to get to in a second, Der Spiegel, which is the big, you know, world famous magazine that everybody knows, they printed a cover of their magazine, which was exactly the same artistic concept that I used on the cover of my book. The cover was a big, fat swastika covered by a German flag, right? And I think the question was, is it happening again? Mm-hmm. Stern, another big German magazine, at the same time, they printed a cover with a big fat swastika floating in a martini glass. And what people need to understand is the authorities and the cultural establishment, they do this all the time. They use swastikas all the time. The reason it wasn't a problem for Der Spiegel or Stern is because they were using their swastikas to compare the AfD party, Alternative for Deutschland party, to the Nazis, whereas I was using it to compare the German authorities to the Nazis.
Right.
This kind of brings me to my second trial. Another thing that people, Americans, are usually shocked by is in Germany, the prosecution can appeal an acquittal, which they did. The prosecutors didn't like my acquittal. They appealed it. We went to appeals court, and of course, the appeals court overturned my acquittal and convicted me of this hate crime. Basically,
what was the grounds for their appeal? Like, what did they say? They said, "Oh no, he actually was promoting Nazism." I mean, what could they possibly say?
Well, it's a funny argument. The prosecutor basically said, of course, you know, Mr. Hopkins is not a Nazi. He's not promoting, you know, he didn't mean to promote Nazism. You know, they know I'm an old lefty. I'm an author. I've been writing anti-authoritarian literature for a long time. They said, okay, you know, Mr. Hopkins is not a Nazi. But when he sent these two tweets out, he didn't make it clear that he was criticizing the Nazis and not the German government. All right. So therefore his tweets could, you know, nonetheless promote Nazism.
So by that logic, do they then think that the AfD party are Nazis? And so they're saying you can criticize them for being Nazis because they are Nazis, even though they're not Nazis, obviously. But they're saying, but they're like not. So only if they think that this is like the Nazis, it's okay to use it. But if they don't agree that this is like the Nazis, then apparently you're not allowed to use it.
That you got it exactly right, Kim.
Because neither are actual Nazis. The whole point of using the symbolism is to say, warning, yes, it's dressed up in different clothing. They call themselves different names, but it's the same exact sort of idea. So obviously, neither, you know, the actual German government today is not Nazis. Obviously, the AfD party's not Nazis, but you could say, but it's getting close. It's getting like that, right? And they're saying, no, only if we agree with you. Wow, that's interesting.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you know, come on, let's go back. Again, I'm old enough. You know, how long have people been comparing people to the Nazis? I mean, right. I remember back in the war on terror, you know, and every protest that I went to had big pictures of Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney and all of them, you know, done up as the Nazis. I mean, this comparison, I've been criticized for it, and I take the criticism. You know, people say, you know, CJ, it's way over the top to compare, you know, what happened during the COVID years, you know, to the Nazis. And I said, look, I just chose the Nazis because they are the most recognizable form of totalitarianism that we have. My focus and what I wrote about mostly, I made the point over and over again, is of course, the current German government, the current Australian government, the current U.S. government, British government, of course, they're not Nazis, you know, but what they're doing bears all of the hallmarks of totalitarianism.
Right.
And that's the comparison that I was making. The German government, you know, doesn't appreciate that. Comparing them to totalitarians, to the Nazis, is absolutely verboten. But sure, if you want to compare the AfD to the Nazis, they agree with that, so it's allowed.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. We have to be able to make the comparisons. That's the point of learning history. The point is to say, warning, it's happening again. Here's the warning signs. And you have to be able to make those comparisons, saying the warning signs for the rise of the Nazis are here once again. Here's the warning signs. I mean, if we can't do that, then it will happen again for sure. So they're just in their effort to not, I don't even know what their, I guess their point in banning swastikas, in banning any sort of Nazi ideology in Germany, because they obviously don't have free speech. You're not allowed to say you're a Nazi or support the Nazis in any way, right? But their goal in that is to, I guess, clamp down on history of what happened and to ensure that it doesn't repeat again. But in their attempt to ensure it doesn't repeat again, they are ensuring it will repeat again. I mean, that's the irony of it.
Well, I look at it a little bit differently, Kim. A lot of people interpret it that way, as if the Germans are just being over-enthusiastic. I surprise a lot of people because I'm known as a free speech absolutist, and I am, but I make an exception for Germany. I actually don't have a problem with this ban in Germany. I don't have a problem. I I don't want to see neo-Nazis marching around in the streets of Germany waving swastikas.
Yeah.
It hasn't been long enough yet. But the point that I always try to make is this really isn't a case of the German authorities just being over-enthusiastic or being overly literal. What they did is they wanted to punish a relatively prominent COVID dissident. They wanted to make an example of somebody, and I'm not the only one. They've made examples of other people just like me. The guy that organized the big protests in 2020 was put in jail for 9 months. They seized all of his assets. He's still fighting the case in court. There are other people like me. The point is, they wanted to make an example of somebody. They wanted to punish somebody. And so they found something that they could use legally to justify the punishment that they wanted to dish out.
I'm just realizing, are you at risk being on this show right now? I mean, you're in Germany, you're still fighting this case, and we're talking and we're saying the word Nazi over and over. Are you putting yourself at risk by being here?
No, I can say Nazi, 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 yeah, all day long. I can actually reach over and hold up the book in question. There it is.
Why are you able to do this?
Want to see it because it doesn't really make any difference now. Okay. They couldn't technically go after me for the book, which is why they went after me for the tweets. Right. Germany, this is another thing that a lot of Americans don't appreciate, is there is actually free speech protection in Germany. It's not as strong as the First Amendment in the U.S., but it's written right into the German Constitution. The prosecutors and the German authorities, they understand the law. They understand the German Constitution. It's not a matter of misinterpretation. They wanted to make an example of somebody. They wanted to put someone's head on a spike outside the castle walls to intimidate everyone else into silence. And they found a part of the law that they could use to do that. That's what happened.
Okay, so the going back to the appeals court, the judge says, "Yeah, we're going to continue charging you. We're not going to say that this was you shouldn't have been acquitted." So then, what happens from that point?
It was a really interesting feature of that trial is they held the trial in a special room where they hold terrorist trials. So there were strict anti-terror protocols that were enforced during the second trial. You know, everyone had to get scanned. No one was allowed. The press wasn't allowed to bring any writing instruments or computers or cameras or anything into the courtroom. It was really quite a show. It was quite a farce. They obviously planned to overturn my acquittal from the beginning, and they did it in a pretty cursory fashion. At that point, that's it. I'm convicted of this crime. And the only thing left for us to do was to appeal to the German Supreme Court, which is the Bundesverfassungsgericht. It's the constitutional court here in Germany, which we've done. And so now my lawyer and I were in a waiting mode, waiting to hear whether the constitutional court will hear our case or not.
So at this point, when the appeals court overturned the original acquittal, are you just charged with a crime, or have you been convicted?
Technically, I've been convicted.
Okay, and what's the punishment?
The process isn't over, but as it stands right now, I'm convicted.
You're convicted. Okay.
The punishment, my original punishment, it's a strange procedure here in Germany. The first letter that I got was basically, you're charged with this crime and the penalty for you is 60 days in jail or 3,600 euro fine. All right. They calculate the fine based on how many jail days it is. That was the original punishment. At this point, it's unclear. It's up in the air again. According to the law, they could send me to prison for, I think, up to 3 years. And I don't know, somebody would have to do the math on the fines.
But they're not going after you to serve that time just yet or to be punished just yet. Is it because this is being appealed again to the Supreme Court of Germany?
Exactly. Yes. Everyone is waiting on the decision from the Constitutional Court, from the German Supreme Court.
Okay.
If the Supreme Court refuses to hear the case, then I will go back to district court for sentencing. If the German Supreme Court hears the case and rules against me, then I'll go back to district court for sentencing. And if they hear it and rule in my favor, I'm not sure what happens. Maybe it's all over.
Right. Okay. Well, let's hope for that for sure, because this does seem to me very ridiculous. But I'm not German, and I've never lived in Germany, so I don't know the thinking of the people. What's been the reaction of people around? I mean, you know, maybe it's like a distorted group because these are your friends. But have you had people say, "Yes, you were wrong, CJ. You shouldn't have done this, and we condemn you"?
Yes, I have. Not people that I necessarily consider my friends, but acquaintances and, you know, professional contacts and what have you. And, you know, I think the majority of German society is still pretty much where they were back during the COVID era. People like me are considered, anti-Semitic, far-right, extremist, conspiracy theorist, anti-vaxxer, anti-science deniers. We were called COVID deniers. We were demonized with just everything that you can think of. And I think the majority of German society still sees us that way. Thankfully, there was from the beginning and still is a really outspoken minority of Germans who have been pushing back against this from day one.
What is it that you think creates? I mean, Germans are logical, smart people. What do you think it is that creates this? This thinking. I mean, it's just so different. The fact that they would crack down on a swastika on a mask and say, "Oh, you were so wrong," and that people would go along with this and agree with it. I'm just trying to understand their psyche.
I don't know if it's really that different, Kim. If you look at the way Germany behaved, the German authorities and the German masses during the COVID era, if you compare it to Australia, for example, or some parts of the U.S., on the coasts and in the U.S., in Canada, if you look at what happened when the trucker protest happened in Ottawa and the way they were, cracked down on eventually, I don't really think that it's anything unique to Germany. There is a part of it that is purely German just because it's German culture. I try to stress to people that I'm not really picking on the Germans. I experienced that whole period of time and this whole prosecution here. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little biased because it's where I live. But essentially, I don't really think it's that different from anywhere else.
Did the U.S. administration step in to help you out at all? Anybody or the U.S. government,
no.
Anyone from the U.S.?
No. Journalists did. Matt Taibbi was one of the first ones to pick up on my case and to shine some light on it. I forget what they're called, or what the acronym stands for. They're the new ACLU, they got on the case and have done a lot. James Kirchick wrote a piece for The Atlantic, of all places, and then journalists in other countries have picked up on it as well. I think most recently, I was pretty surprised that J.D. Vance tweeted about it I think it was about a month ago. So there's that. But no, nobody from the administration, from the former administration, did anything.
And how much has this case, I don't know what it's like in Germany as far as getting your attorneys to help defend you. Did you have to hire attorneys? Do they cost a lot of money? Like, what's the process there? Or do they give you attorneys to fight on your behalf?
No, you have to pay your own attorneys. I don't think that the legal fees compare to the fees in the U.S., but it's not cheap. I mean, lawyers are lawyers, and they cost money. I'm incredibly grateful. I hate asking for money, and I had never done it before. But a very smart lady friend of mine said, no, you need to ask for help. And so I did. I put the word out, and my readers just poured donations in, poured legal support in. And that has, they have covered most of my legal fees, and I'm incredibly grateful for it.
Have you had any other consequences, like loss of job, loss of income, or anything related to that? Or has this just been the legal? I mean, the legal battle is scary enough, especially in a foreign country with a foreign language and foreign laws. But was there any other, you know, were you censored, canceled? Were you not allowed to go anywhere in Germany? I mean, was there anything else that happened during this?
No, nothing like travel restrictions. And I want to be careful how I say this, because there are, you know, there's a potential legal case here. As I said, I'm an author, and they have banned my book in various countries. So that affects my income. They have basically made me a hate criminal. So that's kind of damaging to my reputation and income as an author. I'm an old, you know, lefty who's written, you know, anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist stuff for 30 years. What they've done has, I think it's seriously damaged my reputation and my income.
I think lately, like you said, you're an old lefty, so you've been around, you know, and you've been studying this stuff and writing about this stuff for a long time. But do you think this is new? The crackdown on speech. We're seeing this not just in your case and what's gone on in Germany, but we're also seeing this throughout the UK, right? We see the police showing up to people's homes because of social media posts. Here in the United States now, we're seeing the crackdown on anti-Semitism, right? If you are opposed to Israel, if you're not aligned with Israel, then we're going to crack down on you essentially and call it anti-Semitism. So we're seeing this sort of, it feels like the facade of free speech is coming crumbling down. The facade of Western democracies, Western freedom, that we are free from government overreach and tyranny, that seems to be crumbling right in front of our eyes. Do you think this is new, or is this something that's been going on for a really long time? We just weren't paying attention to it, or people were paying attention to it, but it's just now with social media, we can amplify the fact that this is happening. Or is this a turn, like a change, a shift?
It's a shift. You just walked right into my wheelhouse, because this is what I've been writing about for years. I started with I was a playwright for many years, and you know, I wrote a novel in 2017. But I started writing my my political satire, and sometimes a little bit more serious theory, 2016. And at first, what first got my attention and got me started doing that was this populist uprising in Europe. It started with Brexit and the rise of various right populist parties in Europe, and then of course Trump, the whole Trump phenomenon, what have you. And I covered the establishment's reaction to that. I had written previously a little bit about the war on terror. Let me try to make this concise and make it clear. I think what we are experiencing is new, and it really started about 35 years ago. What happened about 35 years ago is the Soviet Union collapsed, and that was kind of the last real ideological adversarial equation that existed. What happened is around 35 years ago, we became a single ideology world. And, I call it globocap sometimes. It's global capitalism. And that really is absolutely unprecedented in human history. We've never been in a place in history where the entire world is dominated by a single ideology. Mm-hmm. When a single power system, when a single ideology dominates an entire territory, and it does not have any outside adversaries anymore, any outside enemies, or any outside ideological adversaries, it really has nothing left to do other than, you know, the military term is clear and hold, right? I don't know if you're familiar with this term, you know, any occupying force. Okay, so you've conquered a country, you're occupying the country. What do? You survey the territory, you look for little pockets of resistance, and you neutralize them. And at the same time, you spread and you try to create uniformity with your new ideology in the country that you're occupying. That's what's happening. It's just happening throughout the entire planet.
Yeah.
The war on terror was kind of the beginning of it. There was that early period where, you know, Yugoslavia and what have you in Eastern Europe and, you know, the establishment didn't quite know what was going on because they were in a new territory, a new place. And then, whoops, war on terror comes along because there's a big pocket of resistance, you know, to the domination of global capitalism in the Middle East. And so that we had the war on terror for 16 years or what have you. And then suddenly in 2016 or thereabouts, oh, the establishment turns around and says, oh, now we're getting all of this resistance rising up, you know, not in the Middle East, but right here at home. In Western Europe, in the United States, in Western countries. And this is when that same machine, that same clear and hold machine, gets turned on the Western public. And a lot of people have written about this without the context, but you can see the shift in 2016. This is when the heavy censorship of social media starts. This is when the, you know, just the crackdown on dissent in Western societies begins. It rolls right into the COVID era, which I've written. People can read my earlier books. I've written countless essays about this. It rolls right into the COVID era. It rolls right into the, you know, the removal of Trump after his first term, and the Biden inauguration spectacle where all of DC was locked down and occupied by soldiers. No one was allowed to attend. There was a field of flags where the public usually is. I could go on and on about this. What I believe we're experiencing, Kim, and it's hard for people to get their heads around it, is we're experiencing this new system, which is really a global system, a global ideological system, doing the only thing that it really has left to do, which is evolving into a new form of totalitarianism. It's not Nazism. It's not Stalinism. It's different. It has a lot of the same features. It has a lot of differences, and I've written a lot about this. But I believe what we are experiencing is this new global system evolving into a much more totalitarian form. And that's how I interpret pretty much everything that's happening these days.
Yeah, I struggle with this a little bit because on one hand, you know, I absolutely love freedom. I love freedom of speech. I want to be able to be a dissident, say what I want, right? And anybody should have that right. But I do see the benefit, and I want to say this very carefully because I don't agree with it, but I can logically see the benefit of, you know, like when you were mentioning when an occupying force takes over and then they start clearing out the dissidents, they start kind of uniform, making things more uniform. And we've seen this throughout history where, like, Italy is a good example of this. You know, many of the countries in Europe are a good example. Let's just use Italy as an example. Where for a long time, you know, they had like the Venetians. They had all of these different areas of Italy that were not united, and they would war with one another, and cause all kinds of problems. And then at some point, there was a unification and there was a spreading of the same language. And that often helps unify people. If we spread the same language and even spreading the same religion. And, you know, once you get people to conform, you actually reduce tension between groups of people. Once you get them to think they're the same rather than different, you get people to drop their guns and weapons against one another and to stop warring with one another and instead to be a united front. And then they unite and they go up against a different, different group that's not them. And then if you can unite them, and this is something that Europe has kind of done, right, where they had, you know, you take all those little, the countries that were once even smaller countries that became, you know, like Italy. And now what Europe has done is they've said, okay, now we're going to create a European Union where we all come together instead of Germany fighting France and all of these different countries fighting each other. We're going to unify and become one. And when you do that, we've seen throughout history, there is a benefit to that. There's no denying that there is a benefit in unification of people when you can get them to stop warring with one another and seeing each other as part of their tribe. So now I'm witnessing this on a global scale, right? We're starting to see, instead of the individual countries, now we're trying to become a one world. And I say, I choose my words wisely because I'm against the one world government. You know, I've been very against this sort of thing. But like I said, from a logical perspective, I understand, is there a possibility this would be more beneficial for the world if we were a united, kind of like the little factions in Italy becoming one big Italy and they all speak the same language? Is there a benefit to this? And then there's this idea of, you know, now they've created a space force and they're wanting, you know, to fight the aliens, I guess. And so it could be like the world, you know, earthlings against this, you know, force out there. But we're united as earthlings. And I kind of wonder if there's, as much as I'm against it, I wonder if there is a greater benefit to the concept of us becoming united and one and conforming. There is, I think, a benefit to conforming. I'm a very nonconformist person, so I would be definitely culled out of the herd. You know, I'd be one of the first one cut. So, I'm like advocating for my own demise when I give this argument. But that's what I do see the benefit. And you look at China, for example. I mean, China has like 1.7 billion people. I mean, this is a lot of people to try to keep under control. So when you've got that many people, China is very authoritarian. They demand conformity, but it does keep 1.5 billion people at peace with one another. And I mean, you can't deny the benefit of that, I suppose, as much as it takes away the individuality, the free. I struggle with this, you know, the thinking of, is it better for us to be individualistic and tribal in smaller tribes where we war with each other all the time? Or is it better to conform and become one world, you know, one together, which forces us to have peace? I mean, is that the only way towards peace? I don't know. I mean, do you see what I'm saying?
I do. Luckily, I don't have to rule on that question. I don't have to answer it. I think, you know, when listening to you, what I hear, Kim, is the back and forth, the ebb and flow. You know, I'm an artist, and you know, so I'm a creator, but I'm also a destroyer, because you don't create art without destroying things at the same time. It's yin and yang, and you know, it goes together. What I hear you talking about is the beneficial aspects of tribes, of people banding together, of people saying, oh, we have a common culture, and you know, and this is our place, and this is our culture, and this is the way we want to live. And there are many, many beneficial aspects to that. It at the same time, when that impulse gets extrapolated to the nth degree, and now the culture or the territory is the entire world, and the machine, the ideological machine, or the culture machine, whatever you want to call it, becomes so paranoid that it feels that it has to wipe out any, you know, appearance of deviance from its ideology, then I think we've got problems, and it's time for the other impulse to come in and stop that from completing its movement. I don't know if that's a coherent answer. I think the short answer is I don't see it in terms of this is good and that is bad. It's more of a question of, you know, what energy, what impulse, what trajectory is taking us forward to a good place at this point in history, and what energy and trajectory is not.
Yeah.
I'm worried about the totalitarian trajectory. That's what I'm focused on.
I think it's coming. I don't think there's any way around it. It's kind of like going back to the time of Plato and Socrates, and there's, you know, this era of great thinkers, and they were free to think and free to, you know, have these democracies or to organize in a certain way. And then there was the rise of monarchies. I mean, then you're ruled by kings, and there's almost like a human nature, because that's what I'm seeing even now with what's going on here in the United States with Trump. Is a lot of people voted for Trump. A lot of people supported Trump because they expected he would dismantle government overreach, that he would crack down on that, that he would dismantle, you know, like DEI programs or whatever. But what we're seeing is just a shift. It's not even, we're getting rid of certain government overreach only to implement other government overreach, like the deportation of all of these illegal immigrants. You know, look, I'm all for get rid of all the illegals. Fine. By all means, but to use terrorism as the mechanism to say, well, these are terrorists, to use that as the mechanism to get rid of them without due process is extremely alarming. And to me, you know, but I'm seeing all these people on the right who they agreed when it was terrible when it was used against the J6ers. It was terrible when it was used against the COVID, you know, those who were anti-COVID mandates. It was terrible when they called them terrorists and went after them and the parents at the school board meetings and, you know, the pro-life activists or whoever. But suddenly it's okay to use it when we're going to go after the illegal. And then Trump sits there in the White House and says, we're going after homegrowns next. And he goes on Fox News and says, mm-hmm. We're going after homegrowns next. I mean, how do they cheer this on? Or the cracking down of, you know, we're going to get rid of DEI and safe spaces for Black and trans, basically, but we're going to create safe spaces for Jews in the universities instead. Like the swapping is not, that's not what many of us were looking for. We were looking for a dismantling, not a swapping, and we're getting a swapping. And, but the problem is that all these people who were the freedom fighters and the, First Amendment, free speech, they're going along with this now. I mean, it's almost like human nature to just go along with dictatorial mandates. It's just pick the mandate you like.
Yeah, well, I mentioned it in my recent piece, but it's what you're describing is breaking my heart. What I saw and what I experienced happening during the COVID era is there was, I don't know whether to call it a movement or it was a phenomenon. There was a nonpartisan or cross-partisan, there was a heterogeneous, you know, a collection of people pushing back against this new authoritarianism, totalitarianism, whatever you want to call it. And what you described is sadly exactly what's happening. So Trump wins the election and comes in and suddenly all of those tactics, all of those authoritarian tactics, they're all fine now because our guy is doing it. Our side is doing it.
Right.
To the people who we want it done to. I've been trying to explain this. Readers write to me and they say, oh, no, CJ, you know, it's completely different because, you know, these guys are terrorists and they're, you know, gang members and they're anti-Semites. And I have to explain, this is exactly word for word what we were called during the COVID era. Right. We were demonized with exactly the same words.
Yep.
You are repeating the script perfectly. It's just focused at different people. It actually goes back a bit earlier, and I've been writing about this for a number of years now, and making a lot of my readers very unhappy. A very good example of what's happening is what happened with Twitter and the Musk takeover of Twitter. I've written about this a lot. If you look at what happened when Musk took over Twitter, by the time Musk bought Twitter, and by the way, Elon Musk didn't buy Twitter, something called X Holdings Corp bought Twitter, and people should look that up and look at all of the global capitalist entities that comprise X Holdings Corp. Mm-hmm. When Elon Musk bought Twitter, at that point, Twitter was completely delegitimized. Everyone understood that Twitter was, you know, a censorship machine that was infiltrated by the powers that be, and so Twitter's reputation was absolutely shot. So what happens? Elon Musk comes in, he buys Twitter, he rebrands Twitter as, you know, Free Speech X,
right?
And suddenly suddenly, everyone is free on, well, they're not free. X is just as censored, just as shadow banned, just as visibility filtered, if not more, under the new management as it was in the old days. But the branding has been incredibly successful. Part of that branding was the Twitter Files story, mm-hmm. which was a brilliant on Musk's part. The Twitter Files, okay, this is a big story, big, legitimate, groundbreaking story. If I had been one of the journalists that had been offered that story, I would have jumped all over it, just mm-hmm. like Matt and Mary and all the others did. It was also a limited hangout. So a way to whitewash Twitter. So mm-hmm. Elon comes in and says, look, I'm going to open up the books so everyone can see all the bad things that the old management did for a while. And then I'm going to shut the story off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to just shut it off.
And we didn't even get to see everything. I mean, it was only four select journalists and then they tweeted about it. And that's all we got. It was like the Epstein files that are being released right now, where it's just like, what is this? You know, this is all stuff we already knew. You know, that we're not getting what we're being told we're going to get.
Right. And it's part of the rebranding and the part of the whitewashing. Yeah. And I bring it up because to me, it connects directly to what's happening with the Trump administration now. Neither the Trump administration nor any other administration is going to stop globalization. The globalization of the labor force has been carried out for decades now. It's part of the reconfiguration of the world under global capitalism that I was talking about. The Trump administration is not going to stop this. But we can have another kind of limited hangout. We can, you know, grab Mahmoud Khalil and, you know, the Turkish student from, you know, Tufts or wherever. And we can, you know, stick a bunch of tattooed guys in a gulag in El Salvador. And we can feed this red meat to the people who have been creating this populist pushback that has been frightening us and destabilizing us, you know, since 2016. You know, in other words, just as Elon Musk fed, you know, one demographic, the Twitter Files and Free Speech Twitter, you know, the Trump administration is now feeding that demographic. Look, we're going after the illegal immigrants. We're going after the nasty pro-Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. Right, and they're being fed this spectacle.
Well, and they're buying it, they're gobbling it up. That's the biggest problem with it. You recently wrote an open letter to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Jay Bhattacharya, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's obviously the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who is the head of NIH now. And also Vice President J.D. Vance. And in this, you criticize their going after these Palestinian activists. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been the biggest disappointment for me. Such a disappointment. And then, you know, as the Health and Human Secretary coming out and talking about anti-Semitism, you know, this is just, how is this any different than during COVID when they came out and said, racism is a health issue? You know, here we are. We've told you all to lock down, give up your jobs, pour your kids out of school. You're not going to see your loved ones when they die. You know, they did all these things to us. And then they said, but go ahead and go out there and protest for racism because racism is a huge health issue. I mean, it was just like the hypocrisy of that, the ridiculousness of that. And now you got Bobby in there and he's like, anti-Semitism is a health issue. Like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Why are you doing this? This is no different. So tell us about this open letter.
Yeah, I didn't want to write it really. You know, I consider Bobby and Jay friends. As I mentioned, J.D. Vance, you know, took the time to tweet, you know, and bring attention to my case, which I appreciated. I appreciated his speech, the words in his speech that he gave in Munich. It's not a letter that I wanted to write, but I just feel like I don't have any choice at this point. What's happening in the States, what the Trump administration is doing is just so completely horrifying to me that I had no choice. So I wrote this open letter, and you know, I tried not to dump on anybody, but I tried to make the point, and it was an open letter to them, but it's also to a lot of my readers. I tried to make the point that in principle, what they're doing to Mahmoud Khalil is no different than what the German authorities are doing to me. And you know, Bobby and Jay, I mean, I did their podcasts and they've come out, you know, they've got blurbs on the back of my book and, you know, they've been very, very supportive. I've been very grateful. And then suddenly the Trump administration starts doing the same thing in a different context and crickets and we hear nothing. Yeah.
I was going to ask, what did Jay do? Because I know, I see what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is doing. He's out there. Okay, so Jay hasn't done anything. Okay, it would be hard for me to imagine him doing anything. Maybe doing nothing is that kind of the issue that you're taking.
That's kind of my issue. It would be really difficult for me to imagine Jay as any type of diabolical figure. He's like one of the nicest guys.
Right, he is. He's really one of the nicest people ever. But the thing is like, what should he do as head of NIH? I mean, I kind of feel like doing nothing in that role is the. Well, no, I actually think that it's appropriate what he's doing, which is not, why would he need to talk about the free speech case when he's the head of NIH? It's just like, why does Bobby need to be talking about a free speech case when, well, it's a little bit different with RFK Jr. because of the censorship that happened during COVID. So he is a figure where people are looking at him to stand up for free speech, stand up for that a bit because of the figure of who he is. And what he had to battle during COVID and you know, to get where he is today. But Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, I mean, head of NIH, I mean, I want him to just stick to the science. And I love that that's what he's doing.
I don't. I want Jay to speak out against what the administration is doing. And again, I consider them both friends. I did not want to write this letter. But basically, they're both parts of this administration. They're in powerful positions within an administration that is just increasingly blatantly totalitarian.
Yeah.
I mean, they're rounding up people based on, you know, some report by some anonymous, you know, confidential informant that says, hey, that guy's a gang member. Oh, right. Great. Let's put him on a plane and send him off to a gulag in El Salvador for life. You know, it really doesn't get much more totalitarian than this. Mm-hmm. And just the messaging that is being pumped out with Christy, what's her name, who's the head of, you know, DHS no. dancing, you know, yeah. In front of the jail with the, you know, the tattooed guys. I mean, it's, I don't even know how to satirize this stuff because it's already at the level of dystopian satire. So, so I understand the position that Jay is in. I understand the position that Bobby is in, but you know, you get to a point and we're at the point where you need to say something, right? You need to at least stand up and you know, it's the United States of America. Can you not stand up and criticize the actions of your own administration?
Yeah,
I think you can.
Well, I guess you make a point with Jay. I mean, because Jay was part of the Twitter files, you know, he was censored. And so he did have that aspect of him. And he was, you know, really came into the spotlight for being censored during COVID after coming out with, I thought, extremely sensible, you know, conversations around the COVID pandemic and the Great Barrington Declaration and whatnot. But he was a figure for free speech in that. So I could understand that to a degree. More than anything, I just wish Robert F. Kennedy Jr. would shut up. I mean, I would rather than speak up, just be quiet. Like, just don't say anything anymore. Just stop waving the Israeli flag. Like, just stick to health. You know, stick to Maha. That's what I'd rather him do than what he's doing now. But even better would be speaking up for the rights of free speech and you know, having a more consistent stance.
Yeah, I think we're at a point already. It's happened so quickly, but I think we're at a point where people of conscience, people who have principles, who still have some respect for what remains of our democratic rights and principles, don't have a choice. They need to be speaking out against what the Trump administration is doing. You know, I didn't want to do it. The timing of this, you know, really sucks for me. I've lost a good chunk of my audience who now, you know, hate me and they write to me and, you know, call me a commie and, you know, all kinds of stuff because I'm not on the team. But it's, you know, I need to be able to look myself in the face in the mirror in the morning. And I put this in the letter. There comes a time when things get so ugly, when you have to speak out, you have to say something.
Yeah. There is a little hope, I would say. You know, what I am liking is I am seeing a lot of the people who were MAHA on the right, MAGA, and they are pushing back. You know, they're standing up and saying, wait a minute, this isn't what I was thinking, right? We are seeing that. So there's hope. What I'm liking that I'm not seeing, like, you know, what the Democrats accuse the right of being, which is just cult-like mentality. They can't think for themselves. They just follow Trump no matter what. And we're actually seeing a massive amount of division on the right on a variety of topics. One of them being the Palestine issue and speaking up on, you know, Israel-Palestine. That is being heavily debated on the right. And it's refreshing to see that a lot of them are saying, you know, I now regret voting for the guy because he's just proven to be Israel first. He's just so bought off by those special interests or whatever. So there's maybe still some hope, I suppose, on that side of the aisle that they're, you know, whereas Democrats, they just all fall in line. And if you don't fall in line, they cut you out completely. There's no hope for you. You know, but at least on the right, they'll debate it somewhat.
I see the same thing. And I think you're right about that. I've been a little bit encouraged recently because I'm starting to see people who, you know, have been my supporters and my readers for a while, and I'm talking about conservatives, peeling off, you know, from the whole MAGA cult mentality. I didn't really experience that during the COVID era. As you said, it seemed like the cult remained the cult.
Yeah.
With very, very, very few exceptions. I don't know if you remember when Tim Robbins came out and said, wow, I got it all wrong. And, you know, and I treated people badly. I was so grateful when he did, you know, just somebody of that level of prominence. But he was the, you know, very, very few exceptions. I am starting to see conservatives peeling off and saying, no, this is not what we signed up. And that is encouraging to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure is. CJ, this has been a really interesting conversation and I appreciate it a lot. So you're just, and I'm worried about your case. I mean, I'm going to follow it because I really want to know how this turns out, but you don't have any idea of when your free speech case goes up against in the German Supreme Court. No clue.
No, not really, not a clue at all. We don't know whether they'll even hear the case. I mean, personally, I think the most likely outcome is that they just refuse to hear it. And then I get sent back to court. We could get notice tomorrow, Kim, or it could be a year. We really have no idea.
You have a new book coming out. So the one book that you wrote that was censored, that one was The Rise of the New Normal Reich. And that one had the mask with the swastika. But you've now written another book, Fear and Loathing in the New Normal Reich. Does this book cover have a swastika on it anywhere? Are you going to get in trouble again?
I don't think so. Some people have been a little curious about the ampersand.
That's what I'm looking at right here. I'm looking at the ampersand. I'm wondering that kind of.
It's not a swastika, folks.
That's true. It's not.
And I'm speaking to the German authorities. It's not a swastika. This book is kind of the sequel. The other book covered the years, my essays during the years 2020 and 2021. This is 2022 to 2024. It covers all of my columns, all of my essays about my prosecution, including my statements, the statements that I made in court that resonated with a lot of people. It also covers the whole Musk phenomenon, the takeover of Twitter, and what I call the rise of the Musk cult. Israel-Palestine is in there, too. I got in big trouble when that all came out. I've been attacked as a Zionist and an anti-Zionist. So I've been attacked by both sides.
Germany's been really, really tough on that one too. Not just the swastika issue with COVID, but also the they've really cracked down on Palestine, pro-Palestine speech in Germany. It's really terrible.
It's horrible. I mean, back when it first started, the police were, Palestinian protesters were just lighting votive candles and setting, candles out, for what was going on. And the police would come and stomp on the candles. And, they break up conferences. And it's really, that's a whole other can of worms. The overcompensation by the Germans is rather bizarre. It's kind of like, okay, we're very, very sorry that we killed all the Jews. So now we love the Jews and we hate the Palestinians.
Right, right. Yeah.
So that ugliness, that authoritarian, totalitarian ugliness is now just getting directed against, pro-Palestinians and Israel critics. But that's fine. That's okay, because we love Israel and we love the Jews.
Yeah. When I was in Germany, I noticed that they really overcompensate. And this was way before, anything going on with Israel, with this current conflict between Israel and Palestine. They were, when I talked to Germans, they were just very, they brought it up a lot more than I thought they would. It just kind of comes up in conversation a lot, like the Holocaust. And they're like, they mention things a lot to try to express how sorry they are, to express how big of a mistake it was. It's very much on their brain, on a fairly, it's just right there for them. They must be bombarded constantly with, hey, feel shame, feel shame, feel shame, because I really noticed that a lot when I was there.
Yes, yes. Well, yeah, they are. And it's a big issue for a lot of people. I think it might be overdone, but at the same time, I really don't have a problem with it. Kim, it hasn't been that long, historically speaking. So I'm kind of okay if the Germans are still trying to, work out their shame over that period in history. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, yeah. CJ Hopkins, we do have a link down below to where people can, I guess it's pre-order at this point, the book, because it's not out yet, Fear and Loathing in the New Normal Reich. So we do have the link down there for people to pre-order. Also, we have the link to the old book, too, which I think people could still buy here in the United States, right?
Yes.
Still able to get it here, so maybe make that a protest purchase.
You can get it everywhere except Germany, Austria, and the Netherlands.
Okay. CJ Hopkins, we also have a link to your Substack down below. Thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate your time.
Kim, it was a real pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.